Reconvene the hearing. I see that we have on our tables the operative version of chapter 22.
Yes, you do. I thought it would be helpful that we're all working off the same document. But Mr. Bryce has just told me it doesn't include the additional rule in chapter 15, so perhaps it's not as helpful as I would have thought.
I was thinking before this got looking at 27.4.1, the table there on the provisions. Sorry, this is in Mr. Bryce's version of chapter 27. Where it has, for example, 25 earthworks, 22 ODP. I'm wondering whether it'd be more helpful that for the ones that are operative and are not going to be subject to any further notification other than to bring them into line with this, should actually just say operative and then refer to where you would find them on the ODP.
Yes, I think that
is
the operative.
Yeah, it's only a minor point, but I'm just thinking in terms of clarity.
Yes.
It's something that's been inconsistently dealt with so far in various chapters, but by the time we get to the end of them, we'll get it right.
Yes. Thank you for taking that on.
Mr. Bryce, the big issue in this hearing is the issue of the activity, the fault activity classification for subdivision, and it seems a lot of it hinges on this issue of the discretion on lot sizes. But before we get to that issue, I wanted to just to explore with you your wider experience outside this district. Is it your experience generally that subdivision is a controlled activity, so default position in district plans? No, I'm not that familiar with the ones in Otaria, for instance.
Well, I've done a little bit of subdivision work more recently within the Dunedin city boundaries, and it does vary depending on the zone that you're dealing with, but it can be a controlled or an RDA or most recent example non-compliant activity. So it does vary, but I don't think that a controlled activity status is the standard norm across different parts of the country. I think it does vary. If you would like some information on that, I'm happy to delve into that in a little more detail.
It was from your own experience that, because I can ask the other planners that are in front of us, especially those, Mr. Brown operates in Auckland, so he should be able to provide us with the information.
Absolutely.
Up there. So I don't think we necessarily have to do what everyone else in the country does, but I just wanted you to feel for whether A, the operative plan might be exceptional in some ways, or whether the proposal that it be restricted discretionary is exceptional. And I take from your answer that probably neither is the answer.
Probably the most recent example that I can give you is the work that I did in Timaru for the Timaru District Council, looking at so this was as part of the growth strategy work for the Timaru District Council, where I looked at the rural residential zoning provisions. All the different range of rural zones in Timaru, for example, where it ranges from controlled to full discretionary.
Depending on
the type of zones you're dealing with.
Depending on the zones.
That's right. So there's no default. In that case, there's no default control activity rule framework. Unless you're complying fully with your minimum lot and size, or you're dealing with a specific zoning, that's more enabling.
Okay. Now, turning to this issue on the lot sizes, and you have suggested another alternative wording. Yesterday, you heard my question that has got a situation where maybe slightly less than normal, which I think the default position as drafted becomes non-compliant, whether in fact the discretion really is related to those sorts of changes, or is the discretion that any lot size is appropriate?
Well, I mean, looking at the concerns that have been raised by submitters and evidence in particular, I can understand that their concerns are focused on the fact that the way the rule is currently crafted in the 42A report, that it places, you've got your minimum lot size for a zone, and the matter of discretion actually enables council to actually go beyond that and actually, in circumstances, potentially argue for a scenario which is less than minimum. That's my understanding of the concerns.
So their concern is that they'll ask for more than minimum?
I think so, yeah. And I think that's a valid concern, but in terms of the mechanics of that matter of discretion, if I take a step back and actually explain why I'd integrated it into this rule framework, there was a group of submitters, and I can actually take you to the... So using my 29th June, there's a group of submitters who specifically sought to include a control activity rule, and that's listed at paragraph 10.6 of my 42A. And so, as I've explained in my report, I felt that the matters of control in that rule framework that had been suggested at paragraph 10.6 was actually quite helpful.
Right, and since then...
And there has been a retraction of that position by a number of those submitters to delete the minimum lot size.
Is it some or all of them?
That's a good question.
Might have to check that.
Yes, we'll need to check. So it's essentially the parties listed under footnote 24 on page 20 of the 42A. And just looking at a number of those parties, from memory,
I'm just looking at the numbers on the front of Mr. Goldsmith's memorandum.
Yes.
And I don't see party 610. Or 613.
Mm-hmm.
It might pay to check that, in fact, those were all exactly the same, because it yes, may still well. Be alive.
But yes, yes, sure. We'll check that. So just taking a step back, that the explanation as to why the lot size has been pulled through into the ADA rule framework. So I think it's helpful to have that understanding. So there wasn't an intentional position from my perspective that we needed to look at lot sizes as part of our discretion. It's just simply being pulled through from that control activity rules framework. And in most instances, the rule under the rule 27.6, which identifies the minimum lot sizes, covers most of the more sensitive zones with a minimum lot size.
When you say more sensitive from what perspective?
Well, I mean, for example, the rural lifestyle zone. That's probably, out of the rural living zones, probably one of the more sensitive because it does actually incorporate areas that are zoned outstanding natural landscape.
No, it can't. Logically, because the provision is quite explicit that outstanding natural landscapes only apply in the rural zone.
Sorry, my understanding was.
There may be lines on the map drawn like that, but.
Yes, I'm probably referring to my understanding of the rural lifestyle zones as they stand under the operative plan provisions, not the proposed district plan provisions, where those lines have probably changed. But notwithstanding that, that's what I refer to as more sensitive zones. Now, looking at the evidence, the planning evidence of Mr. Brown. Mr. Brown suggests that a way around the concerns raised by his clients, and in his opinion, it may be more appropriate for the council to focus our attention for a matter of discretion around those lot sizes that have no minimum specified under Rule 27.6. And I consider that that has some merit and possibly goes some way to address the issues and concerns raised.
And what zones are those?
I'll take you to that table, 27.6. So Rule 27.6.1 specifies the zone's minimum lot size or minimum lot area. So town centres, there's no minimum. Local shopping centre, no minimum. Airport mixed use zone, no minimum. Obviously the rural zone doesn't apply because it's discretionary under a different rule framework. Millbrook and Waterfall Park, but then they're both controlled under a construction plan rule framework. So you're only really talking about stage one zones, you're only really talking about two zones essentially, or three zones.
Which are business zones anyway.
Correct.
Just in the scenarios that we discussed with Mr. Wallace yesterday, where it may be necessary, and I think to some extent even the consent that you, the Ultravide Holdings consent that you passed up, you'd have a situation where a subdivision proposed for one lot might limit the ability of an adjacent lot, which is appropriately zoned, be developed subsequently, if to provide access, to provide a road reserve through to that requires the rearrangement of the lots, doesn't that require some discretion on the lot sizes to enable that rearrangement?
Dealt with. So you're talking about a scenario where you've already got the consented.
We've got the application.
You're talking about a variation to an existing subdivision, for example.
No, you've got an application coming in showing a subdivision plan.
Yes.
That doesn't provide. And I'll give you an example because I had to deal with this in two consent hearings. Mathias Crescent and Arthur's Point, when that subdivision consent was granted, no provision was made for access to land which was located off the end of a very long and narrow easement from Batley Road.
To another piece of land?
Yes. And the only solution, the obvious solution would have been to provide a road reserve through so that this piece of low density zone land could be developed. They actually subdivided and presumably as a controlled activity with a lot there.
Mm-hmm.
The adjacent landowner had to buy the lot and then get an access way over it under the local government. And those are the situations where proper planning requires the applicant, considering the application, the planners should be saying access has to be provided to the adjoining land, otherwise it can't develop.
Mm.
And we need to have a road reserve there, so you're going to have these lots and different sizes to achieve that.
Yes, I'm just thinking about whether or not those sorts of issues are dealt with under the transportation section.
Well, it's the subdivision consent dealing with it.
Yeah.
And isn't the point of dealing with the infrastructure to consider the ability of all the infrastructure to be applicable in providing for future development?
Yes, it is. I guess that I'm still going back to the issues that have been raised by submitters. I guess we could provide great comfort to them if you were actually essentially narrowing in on the issues of potential concern around what you'd be looking at a different scenario like that.
Then that's the obvious one that I can think of, apart from the ones that Mr. Wallace talked about. But road reserves may not be wide enough, mm-hmm. and they need to. So you need to adjust the lot sizes for that. And maybe your discretion, if you focus the discretion on the ability to use the lots, that's not providing for the ability to provide wider road reserves
mm-hmm.
or new road reserves. And the bald lot size discretion may be too much. But there are instances, in my experience of subdivision, where you do have to deal with these issues.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose the other question, and it's more a question from a Scott that I perhaps should have raised with you, I don't know that this is a particularly unusual provision for a subdivision. Rule as restricted discretionary activity, you have discretion as to lot sizes, even with minimum lot sizes provided. I'm wondering if you're aware of any environment court cases where the court has agreed to a council increasing the lots sizes without the sort of reasons as to infrastructure, etc., that I think the submitters seem to be scared of.
Not on the top of my head, but I will go back and have a look and respond to that in the council's reply.
Well, we're talking about foreseeable scenarios. Put on the table the fact that the council's call, Mr. Faulkner, to talk about good subdivision design. And I had a discussion with him yesterday about, well, where does subdivision design stop and urban design start?
Mm-hmm.
And, like, it's clearly a big grey area, but equally clearly, road layouts are an intrinsic part of subdivision design. And as soon as you alter a road layout, you're going to alter on an unders and overs basis the sizes of the lot of the allotments that are originally proposed. So that may be, and I would imagine, I'll ask the developers this, or those representing the developers, I don't know if we'll actually see any developers, they won't care as long as they've still got the same number of units.
Well, they may care if the road alignment actually requires them to go from, under this rule framework, from an RDA rule framework to a non-compliant. If the lots had to be reconfigured in such a manner as to not actually comply with the minimum lot size, for example.
Well, that's a...
That comes back to my very first question.
Exactly.
And I can see that that's not when...
It's not an unforeseeable situation.
No, I mean, taking your example, even though the property that I have is proposed to be zoned large lot, if the large lot zone minimum site size was 2,000 square metres, ours is 995. Now, I think that no one would really be able to tell the difference between 2,000 and 995,
mm-hmm.
except on the plan. So there is a point at which that change below the minimum really should be discretionary because it's so minor that maybe it's... There is a point at which it becomes non-compliant, but a point at which it's RDA, and that might be some way of dealing with this issue.
Mm. Yes. I mean, it ultimately depends on the zone, but I mean, I agree with you.
Well, even if it's 450 minimum, and you've got 449, I mean, I don't know that the lack of 1 square metre should have you into non-compliant.
No. That's the arbitrary nature of minimum lot sizes.
Mm.
And I think a lot of councils have struggled with that in the past. So.
Isn't it normal in land use provisions when you have something like a side yard, front yard, or coverage is probably a better one, that for a certain percentage to exceed the limit, that's restricted discretionary, and beyond that percentage, it becomes non-compliant.
Mm-hmm.
Couldn't that be applied to minimum lot sizes?
It could, but then you're adding another layer of complexity to the plan. But I understand where submitters are coming from, where they need a degree of certainty around or flexibility around subdivision design. So, you know, I think there is merit in that approach. Whether or not you link it back to a percentage ratio of the minimum lot size, something to that effect.
That could be as simple as 10%.
Exactly.
It seems to me that the objective of the plan is to be flexible as opposed to the operative plan. but it goes some way, but then it becomes very inflexible by making things non-compliant. Is that a fair assessment?
Well, I think the terminology used in Mr. Farrell's evidence is that applying strict rules like RDA discretion, non-compliance for minimum lot sizes are a hard stick. He uses something to that effect. Yes, I think it's a fair call. I mean, if the council wants to promote subdivision in this district and enable subdivision in this district, in the urban areas in particular, there needs to be a degree of flexibility around that, the rule framework that supports subdivision. My experience with an RDA rule framework and controlled activity framework is, and for that matter, discretion in relation to the rural general zone, is that they all have merit when dealing with different zones. I guess the level of subjectivity when applying a default rule is open to interpretation and debate, but I think that the RDA rule framework that is proposed is seeks to provide an appropriate middle ground between those parties that are seeking greater certainty and a council who wants to ensure that it's got sufficient control over or discretion over issues of concern.
Somewhere that you, it was either in Ms. Cox's submissions or somewhere which referred to you in a different wording there from what was in the July.
So we're referring to paragraph 5.24?
25, yes, 5.24. I wonder now, following that discussion that we've had, whether you still stand by that, those words, or is there some alternative that you think is more appropriate?
Yes, I'll just have a look at, firstly, Mr. Ferguson's evidence and the changes that he suggested to that particular clause. I'll just change that evidence now. I think the issue here is one that I need to be confident in my own mind that there isn't a scenario, as you've raised, and other scenarios that require the council to have this discretion retained. And the exact wording of that is really dependent on those type of scenarios that need to be considered. The change to Rule 27.5.5 and Mr. Ferguson's evidence on page 40, where he obviously refers to a controlled activity status. The intended purpose, and I'll read it out, the intended purpose of any future land use having regard to the relevant standards of the zone. Considering the issue that you've raised this morning, or the example that you've raised this morning, Mr. Ferguson's wording wouldn't necessarily address that because the issue is still a subdivision matter.
Hmm.
So,
well, I'm wondering, given I'm just looking at policies under transport access and road, and 255 talks about the connections of road in.
Yes.
And I'm wondering whether it's the somehow we link that to the connections of infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
I can foresee that as more urban land is zoned, more problematic situations will arise. They're not uncommon for developers don't like putting aside their land for the neighbours.
Yes.
So quite a simple.
Yeah. So the
thing from their point of view.
So I completely understand the example that you're talking about and the fact that you've worked through that in practice as commissioner and the problems around that. So it's very clearly an example where the council would need to have discretion to consider this issue. So in my mind, taking a step back and looking at this example, I need to have a look at and just sit down and discuss this issue with Mr. Wallace to actually look and see whether or not there are other scenarios where the council may need to have a look at retaining discretion around this issue, but work it and word it in such a way that it gives the submitters sufficient comfort that there are only certain circumstances where you would look to provide that, or look, use that discretion. And it would be in scenarios where you're looking at road connections to otherwise landlocked land,
yes,
parts of land.
Yes. I think to assist you, there's actually another example I have too, but the two applications were the large one, land. Larchmont was the applicant.
Larchmont?
Larchmont.
Oh, Larchmont.
And interestingly, Mr. Goldsmith acted for. And so I think it would be worth your while looking at those two decisions. They're both within the last 3 or 4 years. And
Larchmont?
Yes. And there was also, and I think the address is at the place. It's an upward point. Yes, and you're right, I will ask the same questions, Mr. Goldsmith.
So I'm actually laughing because I stayed there on Saturday night. So I know exactly where you're
And the other one was one which was, I can't remember the name of the applicant, but it's the land between Oak Ridge and Lone Star Restaurant in Wanaka on Cadrona Valley Road, where I think some provision was made to access to the adjoining lot. That wasn't problematic, but it was a situation where provision had to be made to the adjoining land, and they took that into account on their subdivision application. But those are two that I've dealt with where I know it has been an issue.
Yeah. Yes, I certainly think that because the panel were alive to scenarios that could potentially impose a constraint on council if they didn't have restriction. I think it's very clear that we need to hold on to it in certain circumstances.
Any as you say, I think the issue for the submitters is the breadth of the, well, in reality, not restricted discretion.
That's right.
And it's about sharpening that up as to what specific instances where might this discretion really be required.
That's right. Yes, I think it's...
Would it be asking too much of you both if we could possibly have a draft reviewed by the end of the week? I'm just thinking that given Mr. Goldsmith's comment this morning that if that was resolved, it would resolve most of their problems. Then it would be useful to have any amended wording circulated before, you know, by Friday, even Friday, so that people could have had a chance to look at that.
This is just in relation to...
Just in relation to this particular point.
Yes.
Yes.
So this point, though, actually is raised in relation to both urban and rural living environments.
Mm.
So it may be that the same level of discretion is required and narrowed in for both of those areas.
But it might be narrowed in different ways.
Yes, there may be different training box and rural living ones here. But the same sort of things can happen there.
It's more likely to happen in an urban environment.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah.
I previously thought it was a bit of a nuisance to have 3 days before the next, before we had a submitter's, but in this instance it would be helpful. Did you have any further questions on that rule?
Which one were we actually talking about?
2075.5.
I think my only question is in terms of probably the same theme, looking to be more specific what we're talking about, and this is common to the suggestions of the submitters, like Mr. Ferguson's controlled activity, matters of control, that I've just went past my eye because you referred us to it, but it's also in this rule, discretion is restricted to the following: natural hazards. And I'm thinking, that's awfully broad. The natural hazard is flooding of a property on the shores of Lake Wakata. That includes digging out the shot over confluence. Can we be more precise? Because presumably we're talking about on-site measures to mitigate natural hazards.
Yes, as part of the subdivision, yes.
As part of a subdivision.
Yeah, absolutely.
That wording is probably about what you want.
And later there's a rule, while I'm harping on about this, that talks about heritage.
Mm.
And similarly, being clear that we're talking about measures to mitigate adverse effects on heritage values,
yes. Yeah.
Then saying, this is about heritage.
Mm. It could be with the natural hazards, it may be, there may be instances where avoiding is important. I'm just thinking the fan zones and areas for avoidance. They shouldn't be zoned probably, but there are instances where mitigation may not be the only.
So that might, for instance, indicate where a building platform should be located.
Mm-hmm.
You mitigate that.
Just it's appropriate that you've raised this issue about heritage. Know that its heritage is not listed in this rule, and it probably should be listed in this rule in a scenario whereby you have.
But isn't it covered by 227.5.9, where if it contains a protected item, it's automatically exclusionary?
Yes, but what about a scenario whereby you have a building that's not necessarily listed, but it could be deemed of heritage importance? How would you deal with that scenario?
Having just been through the heritage chapter, I'd say that this is pretty extensive.
Okay. Well, I just thought about that because I looked at my list and felt that it wasn't there. So,
what I picked up on is in 27.7.1 heritage where applicable. Which is the structure plan control of activity rule.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
Well, that could be more specific to the relevant structure plans, because it's the Millbrook structure plan in particular, isn't it, that refers to, I think.
Yes, and I'm pretty sure that's the wording from the Millbrook provisions.
Mm. Okay. Now, on going to the rural living zones,
yes.
The only scenarios I thought that may alter circumstances on lot sizes there are somewhat different. They may be the requirement for esplanade reserves or esplanade strips. That can change your lot sizes.
Mm-hmm.
The existence of wetlands. May want the wetland to be completely enclosed on one site rather than split between sites. I think there may need to be some provisions for those sorts of things, and it may be that the provision made for them may lead to adjustment of lot sizes, but it's not an arbitrary discretion on lot sizes.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Yes. The narrowing of that matter, bullet point 2, needs to be quite defined as well, to give submitter certainty that it's only in certain circumstances that the council would explore that matter of discretion.
Yes.
My question is related to that, which is, what was the original thinking? What sort of scenarios you have in mind with this test to effectively fulfil the intended purpose of the land use?
Yes, well, I guess if you've got a minimum lot size that applies to the zone, that's sufficient to govern that, isn't it? We'll cover that off. So that's probably. given the fact that this rule applies to both rural residential and rural lifestyle, both of them have minimum allotment sizes, it's probably surplus to requirements. But I do think that, as we've talked about, that we need to look at some measure of discretion governing lot size. So that wording could potentially disappear under the revised rule that I come back to you with.
Yes. Well, the first question I've got is to do with the building, the very first bullet point there. Got the location of building platforms. Should there be discretion as to the size of them as well? Just that from 70 to 1,000 square metres.
Yes. Let's just have a look at the wording of the existing and rules. So I'm looking at rule 27.7.12.1, which is on page 27.35.
I'm wondering if it's probably a good chance to discuss building platforms in the rural lifestyle zone. There is no... the rural lifestyle zone has setback controls for buildings. There is nothing in the zone provisions as they stand that's notified that identify any reason for having a building platform. And when one looks at the operative district plan, it's a controlled activity to have a building platform, and it's a controlled activity to do the subdivision, and there's no reasons needed for either. Are there any cogent reasons for having building platforms identified in the rural lifestyle zone for subdivision purposes?
Well, I think, if anything, it provides certainty at the time of subdivision as to where you potentially have future development.
Right.
And that certainty, from the processing officer's point of view, that when you're dealing with a subdivision and the identification of buildings, or potential buildings through the platform, you're able to assess the degree of its the built relationship with boundaries, the receiving environment, including existing houses on adjoining sites, or activities on adjoining sites.
Well, that takes us back to Commissioner Robinson's question. Where are the policies that tell us all that?
Yes.
I mean, in the rural zone, it's fine, because it's discretionary, and that's got its whole set of assessment criteria. So the rural lifestyle zone, that's just a vacuum.
Mm-hmm.
Any decision maker has nothing to consider. And there's no standards either.
I'll need to look at Mr. Wright and reply to that chapter, and also integrate my own response to the subdivision chapter to address Commissioner Robinson's concerns. They are valid concerns, and I think we need to respond to those.
Okay. Well, you've got, and the Gibson character zone probably is similar, because that's not probably discretionary either.
Yeah.
So,
while you've got 27.7.12.1 open in front of you, does that preclude identifying more than one building platform?
Well, I think the intent is that you're only identifying one building platform per allotment. It needs to specify that, isn't
it? I think it should be explicit. We had submissions in the rural chapter about multiple building platforms, multiple buildings, and one building platforms.
So I did read some of that. requirements detail. I'll have a look at that in more detail later on, but just see what the subdivision chapter talks about, the operative subdivision chapter talks about that.
One other thought that went through my mind that may be worth your pondering. I seem to recall that in the Environment Court decisions that underpin the subdivision section of the ODP, the building platform was tied to a concern about cumulative landscape effects.
Yes.
That might repay you. Has Scott going and finding what the court had to say on that subject?
Yes, I was working at Civil Court at the time when those rules were introduced through the decision of the Environment Court. I think that is commonly referred to as the Seagulls approach. I think it was some of the Environment Court decisions relating to the rural dunal zone. I wanted to look at that.
My next question relates to 2757, the subdivision of the National Grid.
Yes.
I just wondered whether the discretion given for submission from TransPower, the location and height of any buildings on the proposed lots should be in there. It's probably, isn't that a that subdivision consent notice matter will be looked at.
Is a matter of discretion D.
It's got a provision as to the building platform.
Yes, so the location, design and use of any proposed building platform, that could be expanded to talk about
the height. That's the height of buildings which TransPower are particularly concerned about, yes.
Yes.
Maybe also vegetation. They get very
yes, they get touchy with that.
They get touchy about trees under their pot.
Well, that's
life.
If it does that, doesn't it?
Does it? Oh yes, sorry. Yes, that's
it. Yes, the Mr. McLeod for TransPower proposed an alternative rule and her evidence and our legal submissions, the council's legal submissions, I've identified that I'm reasonably comfortable with the amended wording, although in saying that, I would still like to have a little bit more of a look at the proposed wording advanced by Mr. McLeod.
Yep.
So I certainly support the intent of the rule. It's just the mechanics of identifying a building platform and how that relates to different zone situations, because not all of our zones require the establishment of building platforms.
No. Although it's quite common in an urban subdivision to identify in special circumstances a building platform. And
yes,
that may be the intention of the rule.
I think it is.
That may just need the wording tweaked.
That's right, exactly.
Yes.
So whilst I'm supportive of the wording, I would like to just explore the different scenarios and look at possibly changing that. So, and also,
I know that I dealt with this in the Bridesdale decision, because that has to have building platforms identified on several sites because they were adjacent to and partly under the transmission line. I don't know, the conditions that we ended up with there might provide some guidance.
Yes. Well, active examples always help, so I'll have a look at that. Mm. Also, I'm conscious that we're still to receive evidence from from the Aurora.
Aurora.
And witness who's had an accident. So obviously, I'd like to have a look at that evidence to see if there's any changes to this or any other provisions as that relates to Aurora's network.
That was, yeah, so that's what was changed to apply to more of the national grid corridor.
Yes, that's right, exactly.
Yeah. 27.5.11. I'm just wondering, have you considered the the scope of that rule and how that might apply, and whether it, when it's applying to archaeological sites which are not identified?
So it's the latter part of the rule, or not?
Mm. As a former archaeologist, I know that they are all over the place.
Yes, and the difficulty with some of those archaeological sites are that they will not always be known or identified, particularly in relation to Waitapu and the like.
To all the radio squid.
Mm. I take your point. I'll just have a look and see the... So this rule is essentially a carryover from the notified version of Rule 27.5.1.5. Mm. Sorry, 0.6. Yes, the actual mechanics of the rule in terms of working practice would be very difficult to advance a... It poses quite significant problems for plan administration and plan users if they're not aware of an archaeological site on a property.
Is the reality you're only going to find it when you've already started the earthworks after consent's been granted?
No, I think that a good consultant, if you're dealing with a particular area, may actually consult with iwi. And it's through that process where you might uncover issues around sensitivity with iwi authorities.
And in this respect, a lot of the archaeological sites are European.
They are
early farming sites, gold mining sites. I'm not sure if there are any submissions on it, but just...
I'm not sure there's any specific submissions on that element of the rule, so I'll have to have a look at that, but it does pose an issue that we'll need to look at.
That might be the sort of reference that could be applicable there rather than the just or not.
Yeah, so Ms. Scott helpfully just identified that the intent of the rule is to cover known archaeological sites, so they're actually known, but whether or not they are identified in the district plan or not.
Yeah.
So the intent is that they're identified, or known about. So they're either not listed in the district plan but could actually be registered with the New Zealand Heritage New Zealand.
Well, there's a four on the heritage. We call what this calls archaeological overlay.
Yes, or alternatively, could be identified in iwi management plans, but may not necessarily be identified in the district plan.
Maybe then that's solvable with an advice note.
Yes,
to clarify that.
I think that would be really helpful.
Yeah.
So it is the archaeology alert layer, is it?
Yes, that's the one. Same question as 27.5.16 and 27.5.17. They relate to the subdivision of a building platform.
Yes.
And the subdivision of a residential flat from a residential unit. One of the issues that arose, Scott will recall in the rural stream, was the suggestion by submitters having more than one dwelling in a building platform, and the alternative suggested in Mr. Barr's reply was to increase the size of the residential flat in rural areas so that they were, I think, up to 150 square metres. Do these two rules, by making it merely non-complying, setting the council up for future problems with those circumstances?
In terms of the proposed changes?
Well, as the council is suggesting, yes. I do recall in the rural stream, I may have not noted it properly. I do recall one of the submitters saying, if you have two building platforms, two residences, we wouldn't mind if you can't subdivide.
Mm-hmm.
That, to me, suggests prohibited activity status rather than non-complying.
Yes. Certainly not a proponent of prohibited activity status. Having dealt with many arguments in the regional planning context in Canterbury. But I mean, I think that a non complying activity still in part a very special special test to try and achieve. So I think it's still a very difficult rule to overcome.
Well, do we have clear objectives and policies limiting the subdivision of building platforms?
Well, as Commissioner Robinson pointed out, we don't have a lot of
policy. So you wouldn't have a project getting past that. Gateway.
Yeah, exactly, that's right.
And then you've only got section 104 to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
And the separation of a residential flat from a residential unit, I mean, I can understand in urban areas there's certain advantages in that, but I think, again, in the rural areas,
mm-hmm.
That can create much more intense development than the provisions intend, but one of those unintended consequences of having large residential flats. 150 square metres is a good sized house for most people.
It's bigger than our current house. Modest planning abode. Yes. Yes, I mean, I think increasing the size of a dwelling or a flat to 150, whilst it's promoting additional accommodation, it almost imparts a desire, if you like, in the whole framework, or encourages subdivision at a later stage, at least it's shut down through the policy framework that we have to address. So it's going to be quite clear that the policy framework that supports platforms and flats needs to be explored in further detail in this chapter.
Yes.
To be the right compliant.
Okay. Now, a couple of questions on unit titles.
If I can just yeah. quickly, I'll just take down footnotes on these rules. So.
Now 2518, 37518, I'm just wondering whether provision should be made for the pre-1991 developments that need regularisation. The rule is pretty straightforward. If that's post 1991 and you've got both an RMA consent and a building consent, but pre 1991, when no council consent was needed for a unit title subdivision, I'm dealing with one. I don't know how many others there are in the district, really, maybe difficulties between the location of the built development relative to the principal units down on the plan.
Yes, the sort to overcome some of the anomalies. So this was raised in evidence. Raised in submissions by some of the survey company representatives, and which has been very constructive in trying to address some of these issues. If you turn to Rule 27.7.13 on page 27.36, we sought to address the reliance on building code compliance certificate. Was expanded to include, or alternatively, where a building code of compliance to be has not been issued, construction shall be completed or not less than installation of the roof. So that's that scenario, but I'm not sure if that actually deals with the issue around unit titling. Or pre 1991.
Not specifically, and in fact, the one that the application I'm dealing with at the moment is actually zoned rural residential. Was a rural lifestyle. It's one of the other. It was a camping ground. They got unit title subdivision for each of the camping sites. And then all the owners built houses on the camping sites with the council's approval. So as one can imagine, the principal units and the houses bear no relationship to each other.
Yes.
and I'm sure I won't be the only one in the district.
Hopefully it'll just be the worst one.
I hope so.
So turning our attention back to 27, Rule 27.5.18, so specifically looking at overcoming the reliance in this instance to code of compliance that has not been issued.
Yeah, that's a pretty simple situation, one where the unit title subdivision originated pre-1991, and possibly the development pre-1991. The 27.7.13 wording may be also relevant, but that is specific to several particular zones. That may just be need to be explicitly certain circumstances that exist historically.
Mr. Chair, is the issue the word meaning in that in brackets, saying that the building may be completed and there's no code of compliance certificate, which is what the subsequent rule is bringing up?
That rule is specifically for the instance where you haven't done the building yet. That's what that's for.
Yes.
That's, then you're trying to get a consent now. What we're dealing with is situations where you've already had some sort of consent pre-1991. Needs adjustment, and that would fall under there as non-compliant because of various other reasons.
But that would be a technical non-compliance as opposed to an intentional non-compliance under this rule.
But it still discourages the people from fixing it up.
Yes.
And the difficulty is that they, during a situation like these people, you can't get a mortgage if you don't have a secure title.
Mm, that's right.
They're not members of the body corporate. So there are good reasons to make it to create some sort of incentive for people to regularise those pre-1991 accidents, if you like.
Well, then, is the non-compliant utility status appropriate for those scenarios?
That's what I was meaning. Mm. That's not.
No.
That's why I questioned it.
Mm.
I'll let you ponder on that one and. My comment on the next one I think 27.5.20 appears to be trying to cover the circumstances that we discussed earlier about where a consent has been granted, and partly it's covered by the 27.13 now. That may be the revised 27.13 covers it, but that seems to overrule the other circumstances where it would be an RDA.
Yes.
I don't think that's the intention.
Well, we've sought to include a new rule, a controlled activity status rule, we talked about that earlier.
Yes.
So that's one scenario. So that scenario would deal with a completed development where you've got the need for a unit title subdivision.
Mm.
Under a controlled activity regime. So this scenario is dealing with a further elevation of the activity status to discretionary,
mm.
but enabling you to advance the unit title at the same time as you're doing your building consent
mm.
or land use consent.
Could it be a restricted discretionary activity in the urban areas, given that your land use consent would have to comply with the zone provisions?
Yes, I mean, I don't see that there's any harm in that being an RDA rule. It may provide a degree of certainty for developers moving forward that they can go down the pathway of advancing their title subdivisions. Earlier.
Right. I'm reserved for 2 o'clock.